wolfspiritradio.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Good afternoon, greetings, good evening, good morning, welcome, bienvenue, willkommen, shalom, salam aleikum, hi everybody. This is JP, this is Journeys with JP. Today, my journey continues with Walt Silver and Nancy Hopkins. We were last night on with Jay Larson, talking of scalar and all sorts of fascinating things. And tonight we're going to be talking about more fascinating things. I'm sure there's things that will happen today that will come up in the convo. So without ado, Walt Silver, good evening.
Good evening, sir. Good evening to everyone out there.
Nancy Hopkins, good evening.
Good evening to both of you and everybody else out in Radio Land.
That's indeed. Yes, excellent. So, right, well, journeys. If anybody wants to come in and call in for a ray reading or to make a comment, you can call in various numbers. You can call into the Revolution Radio number. You can call into my Skype number. You can call into Wolf Spirit Radio's Wolf Spirit Radio, in fact, has a Skype number. You can also call the landline numbers that we've got associated with those, which is 775-773-3431. And that'll take you through the Nevada juncture into the Skype network and all the way across the Atlantic into my studio right here in this little place. Anyway, so where were we? We were talking about some fabulous stuff.
What's a ray reading?
Ray readings, yes, I can do ray readings. That's about reading your energy and it's something I've been doing for several years, and it's very interesting when I read people's rays. It makes sense why they're in where they are and what part of the conversation they belong to. Really, it's really quite fascinating.
Oh, read me.
Okay. Talk about something that you're interested in, Walt. Shouldn't be difficult.
You mean besides Shungite?
Besides Shungite, I'm interested in that twisty stuff. I've been playing with that twisty stuff, which is where you take a piece of wire and hoop it round a hook and take an electric drill and put it in the chuck and spin it and whiz it, and you make this really beautiful tight coiled twisted wire. So tell us about that. What's all that? What does that do? What is it? What's about?
Well, it has to do with the nature of metals and argon. For those that may have heard of the name or have read his work, Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who lived in this country back in the 50s, I believe. When he studied the nature of, he named what we call prana or chi, he named it argon because it was the detectable energy field that he found in living beings and in organic materials. So based on all his experiments and investigation, that's when he determined that organic materials, anything of an organic nature, even if it's petrochemical, is still organic. It draws in and stores argon, whereas things of a metallic nature actually conduct and repel argon. So a piece of wire, when you take any length of copper wire, and it also follows for a sheet of metal. When you have a sheet of metal, one face is positive, one face is negative. When you have a piece of wire, a metallic wire, one end is positive, one end is negative. Now, I'm not talking positive, negative electricity. I'm talking about the Oregon will go into the negative end, will flow into the negative end of the wire, spinning counterclockwise from your point of view. You're sitting down and you pick up a piece of wire and you're looking down one end of it and your pendulum is saying, oh, this is rotating counterclockwise. It's rotating counterclockwise and going into the wire, and then it's coming out the other end of the wire, spinning clockwise from your point of view. This is the Oregon that's existent in a piece of wire is what causes electrical resistance. I mean, ever wondered if solid matter is mostly empty space? What is it that electrons are resisting against when they flow along a wire? Well, they're pushing against the Oregon that's inside the wire. Well, I've done experiments in my shop of establishing an Oregon flow in a conductor. And if you measure resistance in parallel to the flow, meaning that the electrons are going to flow from one terminal of your meter to the other in the same direction as the Oregon flow, you get one value of resistance. You switch them around where you're measuring against the flow of Oregon, and guess what? The resistance is higher. So I was able to confirm that. So when you take your piece of wire and you're twisting it and you're bringing together the positive and the negative, that Oregon flow in the twisted wire, you have one piece, one half is flowing in one direction, the other half is flowing in opposite direction. So as these two currents meet, the field of Oregon that's on the skin of the metal, they're collapsing, the two flows are collapsing, colliding against each other, creating this field of etheric light that clairvoyants can see. That's why Slim Sperling used clairvoyance as often as he could, because they would describe to him, the field looks like this, it has this color and it looks like that. And for example, that ring that you made, not only does it have a membrane of light in the central plane of the ring, it's also producing a beam of light perpendicular to the plane of the ring. So if you were to hold it up, it would be producing two shafts of light that are emitting from either face of the ring.
That's very interesting. So if anybody wants to know what this ring looks like, if you go to everbeyondradio.com, and then look under products, and it's actually in part of the display of the Shungite pendants. And you'll see it. It's a ring of twisted metal. And there's another device there, which is based on more principles that were brought out by Slim Sperling. So do you want to talk about the AccuVac? And I don't know what that's doing. I don't know if it does anything. I just find it's pretty. and it's really, and so I hung it up, on a string and, hung the
vertically
circle.
Or horizontally?
Vertically. So it spins like a worm or like a barber's pole. And then I suspended that inside the circle. Yeah. Uh-huh. And hung that on a piece of string or very fine, fishing line, and then spin them around. It's very beautiful. I think I'm going to have to upload it to YouTube, but it's a very interesting thing to watch, because the way that the thing twists, they don't all go together. It's not like they're wired together. They have a very free fluid motion that is dependent on each other but not connected. It's very interesting.
Okay.
So I don't think that's a particularly orthodox use of it, because basically what you're doing is creating like a lighthouse. If you're saying that it produces a beam, then yeah, that beam would be kind of swinging around quite rapidly, like a pulsar.
Yeah.
What am I doing with this? What's the thing doing? have I done something that is good, or, you know, what's the deal?
Well, I don't know. And if from everything that I've read of what he found and his experiments and his work, I think that just by sitting inside the ring, the AccuVac coil is just it's contained. It's not doing anything outside of the domain of the ring. That's one of the things that he found Remember I mentioned clairvoyance? When they started playing around with the concept of the harmonizer, the first thing they did is they took two rings and put one inside the other at 90 degree separation. So the clairvoyant said, oh yeah, the beams are, it looks like a cross. You know, one beam is 90 degrees of the other. And Slim commented, oh, these clairvoyants, they don't miss a single detail. it was obvious that that's what would happen. But what, they went further. So they said, okay, instead of two rings, we'll put three rings 60 degrees apart from each other. And they noticed that the field, instead of creating six beams, they actually began to merge, creating like a rounded field. And in order to get the field to rotate, what they did is that an AccuVac coil was put in the center, and the AccuVac coil was spanning the height, or rather the diameter of the ring. So the flow of the AccuVac coil made this rounded field rotate, and it became a toroidal field. So that's the work that, if you were to add two more rings to your setup, you would end up creating a harmonizer.
Okay, so these rings, he had arranged like segments of an orange.
Correct.
But if you look at the other device, now if you go back from that page and go to products, but I put them down as products, but nobody's bought any, but everybody's welcome to, and I have to say Wolf Baby's stuff is beautiful, and do check it out, and she'd be very happy to send it to you.
I like those filigrees. They're so
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, that's her stuff. It's fantastic. It's very, 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 fickle. Fingle? Fingle? Bunga. What's the word? Nimble. With the fingies. Finger nimble. Fingle.
She's nimble, very Jack, fingle. Be quick.
So, sorry, Walt?
Learn this trick.
What's that, Walt?
Ignore me.
Sorry, I didn't hear you. I was talking at the same time. So we're so this other thing that I made, which was actually made from four hexagon formed torsion wire. I call it torsion wire, right? As, you know, I get the drill, zip, up it goes. I made four hexagons that I then soldered together to produce this other device. So if you look on products, it's down on that page under the geometric device.
The one that
device.
Is a Nautiloid spiral.
That's right. That's right. There's a Nautiloid. Now, this is called a cube octahedron or a vector equilibrium.
Yeah, or otherwise a Genesa crystal.
A what crystal?
Do a web search on Genesa crystal.
How do
it's
you spell
the same
it?
Shape, but instead of being made with straight lines, it's made with four. No, sorry, it's made with six rings, and it's the same form that's created by cells in an embryo. It has the same layout. It's a very powerful geometric body. I made one that many years ago. I made one that you could sit inside. As soon as you sit inside, you know, everything changes. Your whole energy field changes. Very nice if you have the space to make one.
All right, so it's a bit like a kind of tetrahedron sort of form inside.
Well, this one has straight lines. Genesa crystal is made with rings, but it has the same faces that you see here. You have, you have six square faces, and you have one, two, three, four, five, six. And you have eight triangles. The only difference is that in your case, all the lines are straight. The Genesa crystal is spherical.
Yes, I see it. You can actually go to genesacrystals.com, genesacrystals.com, and you can see these fellows. And, oh, well, there's one with a star tetrahedron inside it.
Kind of overkill.
Yeah, so what's that one? That's each piece of the beautiful parts of Boat West Virginia. Yeah, so you can see there's a great relationship between this and the thing that I created. So
That should generate a really large field. The one that you have on your picture.
So what do you think the Nautilus coil will do? It's got little tiny it reminds me of a Dreamcatcher.
Well, first off, I have to say because you're using the twisted wire, the organ flow in that spiral is actually going in both directions. So you're actually generating two spirals, one collapsing and one expanding. So that in and of itself is very significant, because that's the thing with the phi spiral. The phi spiral spirals infinitely inward and infinitely outward. So you've replicated that in the energy motion. So that by itself is very significant. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that wherever you take this geometric shape, you would notice that you would get a noticeable change in the ambient energy in reaction to this. Because here, the Genesa crystal, from everything I've learned about it, is that that's the job of it, this cuboctahedron, as you call it. It draws energy in, it balances out, and then projects it back out. Here, I believe in Virginia, they have these botanical gardens. I think they're called the Perelandra gardens. And there's supposedly one of the gardens has one of these huge Genesa crystals in the middle. And they notice that in wintertime, that's the only place where frost doesn't form in the vegetation there. And they attribute that it's the balancing energy field of the Genesa crystal, so which is this body that you've created here. So it's always doing that. It's always balancing the energy of whatever environment is sitting in. And this has gone, you're going a step further, because I think the spiral is amplifying it, because now you have this cuboctahedron riding this expanding and contracting spiral. So have you done any testing, you know, put it in a really rowdy bar or something?
Well, we only made it the other day, and
That's no excuse.
Well, actually, you know, we were processing, you know, we were kind of a bit gritty kind of energy, sort of loggerheads, but we were still, we were both absorbed in what we were doing. And Wolf Baby was making the pendants, and I was making this, swear where there was fire and there was flame and there was smoke and steam. Okay. So the first thing I did was I built I took a wooden, square of wood about an inch and a half thick and about, 8 inches on a square. It must be bigger than that. It's about a foot wide. I found a piece of, when you use sellotape or sticky tape, you have a little core, and it's a plastic core of those, and it was exactly 3 inches because it's a standard size. So I took that and I made a flower of life on this piece of wood. Mm-hmm. And then I tacked in pins into the points where the flower of life joins, the nodes of the flower. And then I used that as a form to wrap my wire around in order to make the triangles for the tetrahedrons.
Uh-huh.
You see? So it's all based on this 3-inch frequency band. I've noticed there's 3-inch, there's 4.5-inch, 9-inch. This is all to do with Tesla as well, because he's saying 3, 6, and 9. You know, things that are built with that have a certain resonance. It's about 3 inches across. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay. And you've set it up so that it's hanging from a chain or a thread.
A piece of 4-pound fishing line. It's very light, so it spins freely. They all spin freely. I put them on a mobile.
Oh.
And I'll see if I can dig up the photo and I'll publish that somewhere. So you can see it. Cause it's very pretty. I made a video, I just recorded it, just to record for the sake of it. It's a rough video, but it's very pretty when it spins around. And because this, there's a certain, you know, it's quite a thick piece of copper, and there's a certain amount of inertia in it. And so when you spin it, it really you have to put a lot of torque into it, and it takes a lot of torque and momentum. So it spins really quite readily and quite, wow, that's pretty fast. Yeah. It's a nice frequency.
Have you used your L-rods to gauge the size of the field it puts out?
I haven't done any tests on it. We've just been tidying up since then. And I've been doing radio. And, you know, we did this Saturday, and I do radio on Sunday. So I haven't had much time to,
You need to get a JP clone so that he can take over so you can do more experiments.
That's a good idea. I wonder if I could use Tesla's technology to clone myself several times. Oh, then you'd be sorry. Imagine 24/7.
You're talking about that film, The Prestige, huh?
Yeah, yeah, that was a great film. Did you see that, Nancy?
No.
Did you see The Prestige? See if you can find it on Netflix or something. It's got Michael Caine. Michael Caine and David Bowie playing Nikola Tesla.
Oh, wow.
That alone is enough to make you want to watch the film. But check out the film.
What's it called again?
It's called The Prestige. And it's about magicians, conjurers, wanting to do the best. The prestige is the da-da moment, and that's when, you know, after what appears to be complete death and destruction for the magician, he appears on the other side of the theater perfectly unharmed. You know,
da-da. My favorite scene is when Michael Caine is talking to the police inspector. And it's showing the equipment that because the character is this Australian actor. What's the name of the the Australian actor that plays Wolverine? I forget his last name.
Hugh Jackman?
Hugh Jackman. Michael Caine was his assistant, and I remember when he's telling the story to the police inspector and showing the equipment, and the inspector says, "Oh, this is it. This is the magician's device." And Michael Caine goes, no. "This was not made by a magician. This was made by a wizard. It was Tesla's equipment." I thought that was very significant that he actually made that distinction.
That's right. Tesla the Wizard, as played by David Bowie in The Prestige. Excellent film. Do check it out. I'm sure it's on Netflix or free TV somewhere. Really, quite a movie. And lots of good twists in it as well. There's things you don't expect, and you know, it's very good. So, where are we? Yeah, magicians, magic and conjuring and...
So this is how you read somebody's ray, by making them talk stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Thing is, you didn't stop talking. You just kept talking about stuff. So anyway, and then I got engaged. So, well, let's put it that way. If I say to you right outright that your rays are 127, some people who have been listening will know what I'm talking about, but you may not. So,
definitely not.
It won't come as much surprise to you, I wouldn't imagine, things that I'm about to say. But essentially, there's the idea that you've been, you know, you've studied this in past lives quite a lot for a long time. And you're in the light workers group, you know, the people who want the truth out on the planet. That's what I call a light worker, you know. People who
an employed group.
The bunch of lazy stoner layabouts who do nothing but fiddle about with bits of metal all day, you know, and stuff like that, and sell it on eBay, you know. Anyway, that group. And your intention is of healing and of bringing the truth. And in your personal world, you'll be quite the crystal based consciousness is basically where you're at. That's the seventh ray group, and it's the group who are, you know, if you say to any person who's got the seventh ray, "Do you have crystals in your house?" They'll say, "Oh, about 20,000, you know, or something like that, you know, as opposed to fifth ray person will say, well, there might be one in my computer, you know. Essentially, you know, you'll be involved with crystals in some way. You'll also possibly be involved in understanding and implementing, natural law, things like that. You might have that kind of interest. But, in general, the seventh ray group are the crystal bearers, the Reiki healers, the, energetic, detector people, all of that kind of stuff. And you'll also had a very, you may have felt kind of a bit detached from the people around you. They may feel a little intense for you, because of your, sensitivity of empathy. And things may have been kind of a little potentially claustrophobic for you as you grew up until you learned how to find your own space and make your own space for yourself. So how's that?
Very good. You should make a living at this.
I should, but nobody pays me. Everybody does the freelance. I am available. You can buy things. Ever Beyond Radio. Just come there. There's all sorts of interesting things. You can download archives for free. You can look at, all sorts of, pretty little things that you can buy by mail order. I also got links to, American pretty little things, like Nancy and Walt, and we'll be networking all of these sites together.
I'll jump in here and say that I actually did have a reading from Jay, a full reading. And, I never let anybody do this. It's not something I do. But when Jay gave me the reading, it was something that I realized that, would really provide for the average person, like a little toolbox. Oh, I've got this and I've got this and I've got this that is within my tools that I understand, tools that I've used before. And I think that a lot of times people get into trouble because A, they don't know what their tools are, or B, they're not understanding how to use them. And in both cases, Jay gives you those answers. So I highly recommend him. Like I say, I don't normally have this done, but I'm talking with him, being with him for a while, it was like, yeah, this guy's got something I want to know about. And I was very impressed with his reading, and I think that it would be very helpful for anybody out there, especially if you've got some confusion as to who you are and where you're going. If you don't feel grounded, if you don't feel like you really know yourself, I think Jay will provide an insight that will give you the avenue of understanding who and what you are and what your capabilities are. So give it a chance. You know, do it.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Just talking the truth.
Especially if you're wondering what you come to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, what did I come to do? My main problem is, which one of these dozens of things have I come here to do? And it turns out that, these days come along and, like, all of them, they all come into it. You know, having technical skills, having, syntax skills, having programming skills, having all these skills, have all kind of come together in the last couple of months, and learning how to manage them. So now all I need is some emotional control pills, and I'll be fine.
Well, you've already mastered learning living without sleep, so that's one you can check off.
Oh no! Don't get me wrong. I don't not sleep. I do sleep. I just don't. I was trying to explain this to someone in California today. You know, she's. Yeah, it's really very easy to find me because I'm in California time. Essentially. So if I'm awake, it'll be, between 9 and 9, California time. You'll find me then.
Jay, don't you see the sunrise almost every morning?
Indeed. Yeah. I see the sunrise and the sunset. I just don't bother with the bit in the middle.
Okay. But you do go out and you do bask in the sunrise, correct? I mean.
Oh yeah, sometimes I'll sit and just watch the sun. It's just is really low on the horizon. The chickens are getting out; they're being fed, and it's my little routine.
Well, that energy level is coming in at those hours, mainly more so in the dawn, but also at dusk. the energy level that you're getting from the cosmos, I mean the sun, but also the cosmos, is really more important than sleep. And I'll say this because I spent 25 years doing this. I mean, I kept telling people that who were sleeping that they were dead. You know, I'm like, why are you wasting your time sleeping? Just keep going. But I didn't realize that the reason I was able to keep going and keep going healthy was because every morning for 5,000 sunrises, I saw it coming up over the Atlantic Ocean. So I was being fed all this energy that was keeping me going, and had people listen to me who didn't have that influx, they would have become very sick. So I suggest to you that don't miss a morning. Go out there, because that's the energy that you need. You don't need the food and the sleep if you're getting that kind of, you know, input of just cosmic energy.
There you go. Cosmic energy direct from your own sun. Yes.
At the right time of day.
At the right time of day. Yeah, because the sky also has different factors in it, different diffraction factors. It's like a rainbow, like a prism. So it will be different at different times of day. I remember you've been talking, and I've kind of observed the same thing, is that the sun is more white than it used to be, and that Cliff High noted it and was saying that it's provable, because photographers who have been using filters all their lives to try and compensate for the values of the sun have to change these filters, and so it is a very, very real thing. Are you in touch with anybody who still deals with that in, you know, meteorological societies or anything like that, Nancy?
Well, yeah, the reason that the sun is white is because it's, we were told a science, surprise, we were told a science about the sun that is actually the reverse of what's happening. It used to be that the sun came together and it was this big white glob, and then it cooled down enough so that it was a yellow sun, and you know, it's going to deteriorate until it becomes a red sun, and then it's going to just be all over, okay? Well, the reality of it is that, no, it's a yellow sun that was fed, is being fed, but got to a critical mass, is being fed the carbon field that's coming at us right out of the center of the universe, I mean the center of the galaxy. So right now, because of our position, and people think of this, we're on the Milky Way, which has got those two arms that are coming off, and we're actually very far out on one of the arms. So as the galaxy and Milky Way is rotating around the central sun, which is actually a black hole, you have this 27,000 years of traveling around, and then you get so that you're looking like down the barrel of the force field is coming right directly out of the black hole. Now, most people think the black hole is sucking things in. Well, yes, in 3D environment, yes, it's sucking things in. We can see it, the light, and everything is falling into it. But when you get into faster than light speeds, you're really throwing stuff out from the other side of it, which is really a quasar. So you've got two systems, two flows going, and right now we're looking at the flow that is throwing out all of this energy from a quasar, which it really constitutes, based on the spectrographic readings that they've gotten, that this cloud that we're into, it's so thick right now that they can virtually not see through it, and it's carbon. So what this carbon and the dust and the different stuff that's in this particular area of the galaxy happens is that the sun is going through it. Now,
it's raining shungite, isn't it?
No. Well, maybe, yes.
Well, look, if carbon's coming from the center of the galaxy and shungite was made in zero gravity, would it be possible that shungite is made in black holes and is squirted out? And that's what the thing is?
Well, my question here would be, all right, but let's finish the sun thing. So that this stuff is feeding the sun, and the sun has gotten hotter. It's white. It's actually changed its entire configuration. And people are going, well, how can that be? I mean, aren't we burning up? What's happening? Well, no, because everything in in the universe, specifically in the solar system, is based on a geometry. So when the sun got bigger, the Earth actually moved farther away and also got bigger. And it was, I think, 2010 when the Eskimos, the Tenua people, I'm sorry, I might be misspeaking that.
Inuit,
thank you very much. The Inuit people began to contact actual TV types to say there's something happening with the sun and the moon because they're not in the same place they used to be. We're getting lost following the sun and the moon through this desolate, you know, desert-like but cold, icy environment. And it was on two different programs, two different stations, and there were three different groups of people that were saying that they were seeing this. And I went on Facebook. I went to a whole bunch of different supposedly, you know, inquisitive Facebook groups I was in. And I'm saying, isn't anybody paying attention to this? What the hell is happening here? And there was a number of cases, but I remember this one woman. She got home and she called her mother and she said, there's something wrong with the world. And the reason she said that was because she had been driving home at dawn every day, and all of a sudden the sun was coming up where it shouldn't. And nobody said anything about this. It just sort of like went away until the balance, again, the relationship between the sun and Earth were what we had seen before, what we knew to be what was supposed to be. But the difference is the sun is still white. It's a white sun, okay? So if we can't see the fact that the sun is actually technically changed, then what else are we missing simply because of the way that our brains have been programmed? Now, your other question, what was the second question that you started to take me into?
We were talking about the color of the sun.
The carbon
and the Shunga. Yeah, because you said and the stars, or there's carbon coming our way. Right. Okay. So what have we been talking about for the last 6 months about carbon that comes from space? You know, what form might it take?
Exactly. See, people, when the reason that we are so into the fullerenes is that some scientists decided to figure out what kind of a molecule would be produced in the vacuum of space. And they came up with these fullerenes. Now, you can have a fullerene that's in various different constructs, but the perfect one is based on 60 molecules of carbon, and it takes the form of a soccer ball. So what you've got is this perfect geometric thing that just breeds torsion fields. It has access to the quantum level in ways that we really aren't understanding. But you can put chemistry in there. You can put drugs in there. You can use all sorts of, because it's like this perfect little packaging. And so we're seeing carbon, but if you were to stand back from coal and shungite, you'd see both carbon, and you'd have to look at the molecular structure to know that you had the fullerenes. So is this stuff fullerenes? I wouldn't bet against it, I'll tell you that much. And it's going to change us. We already know that. The half-life of minerals, the half-life being how long does it take for a molecule to break down, and carbon testing is the basis for age determination and so many different things. But that breakdown, the half-life, which is always stable, began to change in all the minerals. Well, if the minerals are changing like that, what do you expect is happening to the animals and the human beings? There is DNA change already been registered in the great apes. And if you see video of great apes right now, you're going to feel like these animals are different, that they're much more intelligent, that they have a consciousness level that is higher than what you might have felt before, if you will open your mind to it and don't fall on that. See, everything is changing. And if you just keep going back to, well, it's supposed to be this way, you're never going to see the changing. And if you're seeing the changing, then what we're seeing is exciting. You know, I mean, oh my God, as Walt said earlier on the messaging for the Skype, what a party. Yes, it is a party. We're having a party. We're talking about change. Change in ways that people who have been in this business of questioning and wondering and hearing about the Enlightenment and the Ascension and all. It's happening. It's absolutely happening. And one of the reasons this is happening is because we now have been given access to Shungite. And Shungite very well could be, with its fullerene molecule, what is actually bombarding us, which is actually what's fueling that yellow sun that went to a white sun. Now, there's many stories that are held by indigenous people concerning 3 days of darkness. And the 3 days of darkness could conceivably be a upcoming event where the sun gets to a... Say again?
Sorry, I forgot to mute my mic.
Oh, so you have this concept where the sun was supposed to, almost like if you're taking a lawnmower and you're pulling it and it doesn't start, and you're pulling it and it doesn't start, and you're pulling it and then it starts, and then it blip, 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 goes back out, and then you pull it again. Well, it was the same concept that in hearing about the 3 days of night makes sense if you're talking about a reset of the sun itself, this furnace. And so what was anticipated was that the sun would be trying to go from a yellow to a white because of all this excess fuel, and that it would stutter, and that you could have 3 days of night. Now, I think, because we're in reality building, is that there were a number of us that realized, okay, that is a potential, but it's not a necessary potential. We don't have to go into 3 days of night. We can just forget that thing. You know, one pull, boom, it's up. And I think that's what happened. I think that was one of the differences between when the Mayans were talking about, because the Mayans are really into that 3 days of night. Supposedly at the last age, the change of ages, and I never did get clarity on it. Jay, you were on with the guy that was telling us about this. But and he was a Mayan researcher, and he was saying that they said that back in the last age, that there were 3 days of night and people disappeared. And I couldn't get him to tell me, because I don't think he really understood it himself. Where'd the people go? Did they die? Is that what they're saying? Or did they just disappear? And it's conceivable that if it happened, that they did disappear because they went on, that there was a schism somehow in the planet, and it may be that these people made the Enlightenment leap into the next dimension, or perhaps there was a break in the earth. We don't know, because we're too limited. We're not imaginative enough to understand everything. But I'm pretty sure that this was a sort of like a scheduled event, a potential scheduled event, that we got past. It was another one of those things that could have happened that didn't happen. So I'm not anticipating 3 days of light. But if the sun does go out for 3 days, be rest assured it will come back on. Don't panic. But I don't think that event is going to happen at all.
The 3 days event. I had a dream a few years ago, and I was in this place. It was probably up on a hill or something like that. It seemed to be some ancient ruins or something like that. Anyway, but I look up in the sky, and the sun literally off the sky, and I thought to myself, brown dwarf, as if I knew that. In this dream scenario, that the brown dwarf, or whatever we call it, but you know, the large gravitic body that seems to somehow sometimes pass our planet, stops us in our tracks, drags us for a little bit, and then buggers off. If that's something that creates this 3 days of darkness effect as well, it may be the same thing. It may be that the sun goes out and the earth is pulled magnetically away, so there's nothing to shine on anyway. I don't know.
Well, Alan Skofsky, he said that, you know, in Planets in Collision, it was his theory that a comet came too close to Earth and actually altered the rotational capability of the planet so that they had 3 days of night at the time of the Exodus. He goes through and he explains every single thing that happened in the Exodus by way of this comet getting too close to Earth that actually affected our ability to rotate. And he went, I mean, as far as the thesis goes, it's the best one I've ever read, because he believed that if he was right about his interpretation of the Exodus, then there would be documents on the other side of the world that said they had 3 days of light. And that he found it. He actually found it. Now, everything about his, and I highly recommend everybody read it. It's an amazing tract of science. But one of the things that he said was that it was a comet, and that the comet, because of the effect it had with Earth, lost its trajectory and actually ended up going in rotation around the sun and became the planet Venus. Now, when he said this, he was a very, very well-known scientist. But then he got laughed off the stage because at that time, all of the spectrographic readings of the chemistry in Venus was a high ammonia content. And a comet is carbon oxygen. So, you know, it was like, well, you don't even have the chemistry right, dude. Well, the first probe that they got close enough to Venus to showed that it was basically carbon oxygen. And the ammonia was like a cloud effect that they were reading, but below it was carbon. So he was right, and so he was long dead, but all of a sudden now people are starting to pay attention to him again. This is about 20 years ago. Well, more than that now. And but anyway, so yes, the event of a three-day stopping night and day is apparently happened at the time of the Exodus, according to the book Worlds in Collision.
That would also explain the anomaly of Venus's rotation. Of all the planets in the solar system, Venus is the only planet that rotates in opposite. The direction of rotation around the sun is different from its rotation around its axis.
That's right.
If you were standing on Venus, the sunrise would come up on the west. It rotates in opposite direction.
That was one. I think I remember that was one of his indicators.
Yeah, but here's the other thing. Is that I believe in days gone by, and this is one of my real weird radical theories, I believe that in days gone by, the Earth spun in an opposite direction. It went, the other way. And where the sun rises is where it used to set. And so, and to that end, there is a frieze in a temple in Egypt, probably been flooded by now. It's Karnak. And there are two star maps, and one is upside down because it's saying that it used to be like this and it's now like this, which is like how it is just now. And the thing that I have that corroborates this is the writing. When we see the way things go, we look at the sun, and so we move from left to right. Ancient languages wrote from right to left, like Hebrew, which was a language that was created before this cataclysm that causes planets to spin around the other way. So languages that write from right to left, they call them writing, are from the ancient days, the traditional ways when the planet spun the other way. And Hopi prophecies say that the planet will return to its normal spin rather than the spin that it is at the moment. So I believe we are in bizarro world. Everything is backwards and things will return to normal at some point in some manner. That's my feeling. I know it's radical.
Is the only indicator that you have is because of the writing, or do you have some other reasons for saying this?
Well, apart from Velikovsky and the various corroborations he gave in that book, that many ancient writings say that the Earth spun the other way.
I must have missed that. But it wouldn't surprise me because, like I say... This, well, you've read it. You know what this thing is. It's astounding science, the way he went about it.
And awesome, yeah. He went around and looked at ancient almanacs and ancient star measurements by proper astronomers, not astrologers, but astronomers, scientists, and he went through all the things before computers as well. That was pretty impressive. You know, nowadays I'd put everything into a database and then analyze it and take 10 minutes. It probably took his entire lifetime to figure that one out.
Well, it would correspond to the change in the way the writing was. You know, if you look, go back in time and think about the point that he's talking about, Exodus. And the other thing that he said, which I found really fascinating, was the concept that when you have the comet coming in towards Earth, you set up an electromagnetic charge between the two celestial bodies. And that because of the carbon base of the comet, there were like bolts of lightning that were going between the two planets, or the planet and the comet. And that the reason that in Exodus they talk about falling pitch was actually this stuff coming off of the comet and hitting the planet. And where did it end up? It ended up in the very area that we have all these deposits of oil that have not actually been scientifically explained as to why they're there. They give you a reason, but if you really analyze the reason, it starts to fall apart. Remember that part of the book?
Yeah. We've also been talking, or it's been spoken about, a thing called abiotic oil, which is the idea that oil isn't produced by fossil compression and all that stuff. That it's created by the Earth itself. So, I mean, it could be a natural planetary lubricant. Like maybe it's like saliva or slobber. It's like planetary slobber.
Well, we may have two levels of oil too. You know, I mean, there may be two things that are oil-based, carbon-based, carbon, you know? I mean, because I believe, when I heard the stories about the concept of this lubrication between the crust of the Earth and the mantle, kind of, it made sense to me. It felt right. You know, it resonated with me. So it could be that we have that, which... You know, we've talked about this. Jay probably has a consciousness of its own. You know, we've
talked. Well, then there's that nano oil, that black nano oil, which has got that intelligence that modifies people. Have you seen the basis
of the X-Files?
It's in the X-Files, but it's also a real thing in the Amash series, Bases series in YouTube. You can check it out. Bases. I don't know which one it is, but it's a black intelligent liquid. Yes, very much like in the X-Files.
What more do you know about it?
Well, there was a guy talking about it. He apparently they were messing about with something at Porton Down in this is one of our British germ. It's our version of Fort Detrick, where they deal with germ bombs and biological and other kind of warfare, and they were messing about with this intelligent oil. It seemed to have a sort of consciousness, and they couldn't get it to do what they wanted it to do, so they flushed it down the toilet. What a great idea that was. Flushing a liquid consciousness down the toilet into the sewer system. Guess what? Yeah, anyway.
I think it's come back to Shungite.
Well, Andrew Barthes agrees with you, because he's the one who speaks that he says that part of the chemistry in chemtrails is it's a sentience that was brought from another planet that's in liquid form, and it's being used in the chemtrails, you know, to assist in the control of people, but it's not they're hurting this life form, because in the laboratory it became sentient and it refused to do what they wanted, so they're keeping it limited by the chemistry that they're using, which is actually hurting this being. So I don't know how, you know, what to make of what he said, but somehow it seems to be along the lines of what you're describing, a sentient liquid life form. Only he claims it was brought here from another world.
That could well be the case. Who knows where things have come from? And it featured in the X-Files, certainly. So it's got to be something to do with off-world. That was part of the, you know, the...
Well, we know the breakaway civilization has...
Yeah, everywhere.
Been able to travel all over the solar system.
Well, and beyond, you know, I imagine that they're beyond Aldebaran right now, so...
They can't get past the quarantine.
They say what?
They cannot get past the quarantine.
Yeah, they're not supposed
to
leave the solar
system. They know the solar system, but they can't get past... I forget how far the quarantine goes out, but they cannot get past the quarantine. Because, I mean, Earth has been quarantined. The problem with Earth was that my understanding, the story... let me put it to you this way. A story that resonates with me is that there was a group that was confronting what became the Galactic Federation... real evil, and they had them, what they thought was surrounded, only to find out that somehow or another they had, you know, gotten into one of Tesla's vehicles and time tripped or space tripped. They didn't know where, they couldn't find them. And so they sent out, scout ships and Armadas to try to find out where they were. And then when they found out where they were, it was on Earth, and they immediately threw up a quarantine. Okay.
We're going to break right now. We'll be back very soon. And we'll talk about the quarantine. We'll talk about what they've tried to do to get behind the quarantine over the years. Don't go away. It's quite interesting. Yes, indeed. And indeed, your host is JP of Journeys with JP. And indeed, this is Revolution Radio on freedomsips.com, and it's plug time. Do buy the seed pack because it's really good and you get food from it. It's worth much more than you pay. It's a pure investment in the future. If you buy a seed pack, you get as much kale as you ever want. you get as many tomatoes as you ever want. You get loads of things that you can grow all by yourself in little pots. In all sorts of things. They last forever. Well, quite a long time if you stick them in the freezer. Do try to, do give us, some love in some other manner. If you like to, connect in with the archives of this show, you can buy a subscription. It's only $5 a month. You can also, I don't know if anyone's done it yet, but you can also buy an entire year of Journeys with JP. Maybe you could buy two. Get the whole log. I've been here since 2012. It's 2014 now. Well into it. So, there must be a couple of years left of Journeys with JP, and, you can check them all out. They're quite interesting. I've got lots of very, very interesting guests, and, notwithstanding, today I have two more interesting guests, or two continuing more interesting erstwhile before and after here we are guests, Nancy Hopkins and Walt Silver. And we're talking tronics, we're talking orgone, higher energies, dimensional stuff, and the white sun. Now, you see, we're talking about the white sun. One of the things about the white sun is that if you take a piece of metal and put it into a flame, it will glow red, it will then glow yellow, and then it'll glow white hot, and then it'll go blue hot. So, from what I can see, the sun is just along that continuum, isn't it?
Exactly. But they had it going the other way, which didn't make sense.
Didn't it? But everything's backwards, isn't it?
Well, you know, they don't want you to know anything, so they tell you things backwards. I can't explain them. I mean, but yeah. That's exactly what's happening. It conforms to what makes sense based on our own 3D experiences. You know, the more
they're thinking in terms of entropy decay. They think that the ultimate end of everything is the decay, entropic decay, but they don't realize that it can go in both directions. Like when Jay Larson was speaking about, you know, forward going time or backward going time, the same thing goes for stars. Not necessarily all stars will die when they're supposed to die. They might get younger, they might get older. Depends on where they are in the universe.
They may grow into galaxies. Hey, we got the caller. Hey, hello, Eric, code 626. Who are you and what do you want? No, how are you? Where are you coming from?
My name is Michael. I was looking for Candy and her show.
You're Michael and you're looking for Candy. I've heard about you. No, I'm sorry. This is Studio B. And this is Wolf Spirit Radio and Ever Beyond Radio and, Journeys with JP. And you're probably not looking for Candy on this station, are you?
Your studio, well, I'm looking at Freedom Slips, Switch to Studio A, and you are Veterans Today, News Reports, Stu Webb?
No, I'm on Studio B, this is Journeys with JP. So you've called into Studio B, not Studio A, which is where you want to be. A is where you want to be. B is not where you want to be. Unless you're Canadian.
Yes. I suppose there's a call in line. Ah, the 388-347-688-2902.
That's the one.
Okay. I thank you for your help.
Good day, Michael, and may you have a wonderful day. And thank you for being on the air. You have any questions about Organite?
About Organite?
Yeah. Do you know what Organite is?
I pretty much teach gold and silver.
Gold and silver. That's very interesting. Oh, by the way, what's the current price for 999 silver? No, so 499.
Current price? Oh, it's somewhere under 18.
Under 18. And what about 49 silver?
Well, you're talking about being able to get it at this point, so I probably don't know.
Really?
I don't think there is much inventory out there. I mean, they've been lying about it for so long, I don't think they know if they got anything.
Okay. And how about gold? What's the current price? It's always good to know that.
Let me find the website that I use, which is La Metropole Cafe, Bill Murphy's site. Mm-hmm. He usually has a daily closing price, at least on the COMEX.
Excellent.
I don't really trust London a whole lot anymore.
We use these precious metals in our devices.
All of them, yeah.
Yes. Specific.
We use them in satellites. It's how we can put a card into a gas pump.
That's right.
And get approval for credit because of the gold and silver wiring up in the satellites.
That's right. Yes. People have been melting down their PCBs as well. You can see YouTubes and old memory sticks have a very, very fine sliver of gold all along the edges of them. And people have been recycling those and using horrendous chemicals to extract the gold. You can get a tiny little gram nugget out of loads of them. So if you did, what would be the, have you got to the price yet?
No, that's for some reason, this is Mercury retrograde this week in a big way, so nothing's working out there.
Yeah, what's the price of Mercury?
It's going down. Actually, they used Mercury on those Tory gates in Japan. I mean, I'm surprised people haven't been poisoned by those little gates for years, but what do I know? Let me try another site here.
Yeah, I mean, there's the precious metal, but, the metals... metals and minerals is quite an important market indicator that is much more indicative of the real value of things than the hypothecated markets like the financial markets and mortgages and things like that, aren't they?
Right. Well, an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold, to paraphrase Gertrude Stein. It doesn't seem as if that's changed really in thousands of years, but the value that we ascribed to gold in dollars, really that's kind of disintegrated from 2001 or so to now. Gold was $256 an ounce 13 years ago, and now it's, closest I can get is probably $1,206 an ounce, close to the closing price, and silver's around $1,727. The dollar is still hanging in there, but mostly that's because it's measuring things in euros and yen and pounds, all of which are tanking. So the dollar looks great compared to the guys that make up the index.
Yeah, yeah. We're all hanging on to each other as we're going down the whirlpool. Anyway, so thank you very much for making this mistaken call, Michael. It's been given a great deal of information to our listeners. We're talking about psychronic devices and, things that affect your well-being and healing, things like that. So, like we say, we use precious metals and silver and gold plating in these things as well. So it's always good to know. Thank you very much, Michael. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Well, there you go. just if you wanted to know how much your gold and silver is and where it is in the marketplace. Excellent. So, welcome back to Journeys with JP. That was a random caller who gave us some wonderful information about the stock market and the market. Are you with us, Walt? Nancy, you still there?
Yep.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Found it interesting.
Yeah. So quite random, but quite interesting. So
isn't that one of the features of the show? The good random caller hour.
That's right. The random caller hour on Monday. Nancy, you were on a roll just before the break. So do you want to pull your pin out and let it go?
Yeah, rewind a little bit before you got to the the part that you said of the quarantine. What is it that they did?
Right, we were talking about quarantine. Well, it actually was the entire solar system was.
Yeah, can you go right back to the beginning, as far as you can get, and then.
I didn't get that part about the Tesla. Somebody going into a Tesla device. That was too quick for me.
Okay, well, let me get a little philosophical here, because one of the interesting things that I find, well, if reality is what we think it is, and majority rules, and the Bible has a certain amount of truth in it, because so many people actually believe it's the Word of God. So assuming it is the Word of God, let's go back to the first, you know, episode of, you know, what was happening. And you have Eve and, what was that other guy's name? Adam, I guess. Adam and Eve. Yeah, Adam and Eve. Okay, those guys are in the Garden of Eden, and God says to them, do not take of the tree of knowledge. It was the only stipulation he put on them. So Eve's out there, and she meets the serpent, who has been called the devil. I mean, I don't know who the serpent is, but the serpent is there. And the serpent says, oh, don't listen to God. God doesn't want you to take from the tree of life. Because if you take from the tree of, the tree of knowledge. If you take from the tree of knowledge, then you will know the difference between good and evil, and therefore be like gods. And that's a pretty profound statement, okay? That the real trick of understanding everything and to have your God powers, that apparently the serpent even acknowledged that you had the powers, you had to understand the difference between good and evil. And as above, so below. So even on this small little earth planet that we have here, if you just expand it out in millenniums, I'm talking millenniums ago, God only knows when all of this happened. There was a group of people or a group of entities that were doing some really bad things, and another group said, you know, you're doing really bad things and we want you to stop. So you had some kind of a galactic war that started up, and that's when you got the Galactic Federation that a lot of people consider to be evil. I don't. I've dealt with them. I've only found them to be really honest, and they've never misled me. Anytime I've had any contact.
Remember, there's two labels out there. One is the Galactic Federation of Light, which I've heard from another group. Supposedly, they're mostly reptilian. And then the other group is the Galactic Confederation of Planets. They're supposed to be, in quotation marks, the good guys. So there is actually two labels going around.
Well, there might be two labels, but there's, you know, that's what they do to confuse people. You know, I mean, I don't care what the other guys, I call them the Galactic Federation. It's detailed in so many really ancient and esoteric kind of writings. The Keys of Enoch get into them. But my experience has been that, you know, they have led me to do energy work for the planet. I've been dealing with them for decades. They identify themselves as the Galactic Federation. That's what I know them as. And I resonate with them. They're very, the Pleiadians. I mean, there's all different types of, you know, virtually any known ET civilization that is mentioned seems to be associated with this. From my perspective, I could be wrong. But regardless, they had this group of evil entities that they thought they had surrounded. And that they were, you know, trying to get control of them. And I said Tesla being kind of, you know, facetious about it. But somehow or another, when they really tried to corral them, they realized they were gone. And they didn't know how they had left, but they didn't know if they had time tripped, if they had did some kind of a dimensional trip, but this core of renegades was gone. So there was the galaxy started to be a search area for trying to figure out where these people went. And they found them in this part of the galaxy. And that ensued the war that blew up the planet that's between Mars and Jupiter and blew off the atmosphere of Mars and eventually made such a mess of the solar system that Earth became a haven for a lot of the people that had been displaced because of all this war. And at that point, there was a quarantine. It was sort of like, okay, we're going to call it, you know, just like World War II. Most people think that World War II had some kind of a peace treaty. It did not. In Germany, it was just stopped. There's an armistice, period. There was no, you know, formal declaration of peace like there was on the Missouri for the Japanese. Well, it was the same sort of thing. Okay, we're going to just stop fighting, but we're going to put you on quarantine. Because until you get yourselves to understand the difference between good and evil, we just can't have you going around mucking around the galaxy. And that's where we've been today. Those are probably the people that made changes in the human being from the 12 strands of DNA to 2 strands so they could control them. But now, because we're again in the 27,000 photon belt, is what I call it. Other people do too, but that seems to work for me as a photon belt. In this new environment, there's a lot of stories from, again, indigenous people about going around black suns. They talk about revolving around black suns. And as you get closer to the center, to the black sun, you actually, their energy is increasing your consciousness level and your ability to just understand things, your consciousness level. But as you start to go around it and you're moving away from it, then you start to get stupid, basically. And this time around, as we're getting closer to the galactic sun, because technically once you get through the photon belt, you're falling into it again, we are increasing our consciousness. Every time we come around, we increase it again. But this time, and probably in other times, but at least at this time, there are groups of us that understand that it's all, the power's in the consciousness. All of the rest of it, you can't have manifestation without consciousness. And so if you realize that, and you realize that there is a riddle to be understood, that if you really want to understand or obtain true knowledge, you have to understand the difference between good and evil. And I don't think there's any difference between things that may seem bad and may seem good. They're just what's happening. But there is an evil. And that's very difficult for a lot of human beings to understand, is what is this evil? And that was part, when I was writing Cosmic Reality, I got into that question. Is there a devil? Is there demons that can possess people? I don't know. I don't know, but the older I get, whereas I would have argued against it, you know, years ago, the more I see some of this very damaging, very has to be evil stuff that these people do. It's like the fluoride. Why would you put poison, now claimed by the Lancet, now declared by Lancet, the most highly esteemed medical journal, to be a neurotoxin, fluoride, and they're putting it in our water? Because why? Because, well, it makes you docile. It screws up your pineal gland so you can't be connected to your higher self, so that you cannot be connected to your higher consciousness. And that is evil to me. So I see indications of evil that, you know, I don't know how to explain why, where it comes from. And that's what we've still got to understand before we can really grasp true knowledge.
Well, the level of consciousness that would have no qualms about doing this, something like putting fluoride in the water, when you think about it, it makes you wonder, am I dealing with a human consciousness? because I think it would have to be a non-human consciousness that looks down on humans the same way that people don't have qualms about raising chickens by not letting them walk and just putting them in a box and feeding them and just letting them lay eggs all day long, because they are seeing chickens as lesser beings. What beings would not hesitate to poison our water is beings that see us as lesser beings. So are we dealing with a human consciousness here, or are we dealing with something that's non-human?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's a cop-out. I think we actually have a cop-out if we blame it on somebody other than ourselves. Hmm. Obviously, the people that are in charge of the, what is it that you call it? The kill, Jay, you call it the kill, it's the production of food through killing. I mean, this whole concept.
Oh, the death industry.
Death industry. Thank you very much. This death industry, who's operating behind that? They're human. These are humans. There's no control in us. Now, if you're talking about evil that wants to control us by using electromagnetic waves to basically program your mind to disrupt your cellular bodies, that's evil. Now, is that evil because that's human? That's almost, I hope, is outside of the realm of humanity. But it's human beings doing it. And if we can't accept the potential that it is only human beings, I think we're missing the boat. I think it's a cop-out. I would rather say, let's fix the human being than to say, oh, well, we got to get rid of these reptilians. I don't know if there's any reptilians or not. But I do know that it's human beings doing evil acts. Now, where does that evil come from? In my opinion, it comes from most people, and there's layers of this. You're doing something evil, but what's your reason for doing it? Well, you're doing it because you think it's the alternative to something that is more evil, or you're doing it because you're in a state of fear, or you're doing it because you want power over others because you're basically in a state of fear, or because you're greedy, but you're basically in a state of fear if you're greedy. So it all comes back to the fear thing. If you continually are fearful of this, that, and the other thing, you can be convinced that whatever evil act you're doing is really for your own protection. That's a human response to living in fear. So I'm not going to say that it's some ET or some dimensional being. We could. But I just don't want to cop out and say, oh, it's Mary wants to blame somebody else for what is. I'm saying, no, I'm responsible for what is. And if I'm responsible, I'm responsible for what could be. And that's where I'm coming from. The future cannot be predicted. It can only be true. And I think we should, you know, just create a new reality and do it.
Reprogram the past failed programs, you know. That's what I've been doing most of my life, is debugging programs or complaining about programs that they won't fix the bugs. like a la Skype or anything made by Microsoft, you know. Actually, what Microsoft have always done is take a really good product and totally ruin it. Ruin it, so the echo goes. That's the way it happens, eh? What do you think, Walt?
Well, I worked in IT for 11 years, and I always used to argue the point that Microsoft is not a technology company. They're an excellent marketing company. They can sell ice to Eskimo, but they have to, because everything it's fueled by that saintly Microsoft name. But if you look at the origins of Microsoft, they didn't start by creating anything. I mean, Bill Gates did not write DOS. He bought it from Gary Kildall. Bill Gates wrote a little basic compiler, and everybody credits him with the creation of DOS. And it all starts with marketing, because and Nancy knows this because she told me the other day that she used CPM. When the first PCs were Z80 Motorola processors, they had 64K of RAM and 128K of expanded memory. And they would run an operating system called CPM. So here is where When the other PCs came into the market, the 8086 and the 8088, the only difference was the size of the 8086 was a 16-bit bus, 8088 was an 8-bit. The deal that that Gates orchestrated was to bundle DOS with every machine you sell. That was the initial thing. So here you're an office manager and you have to buy computers for the office. And at the time, an 8088 could easily go for $5,000 with a 20 meg hard drive.
Look,
you can imagine how much data you can put in there. And then you have to go and you have to buy a license of CPM, which could easily run you $1,000 or $1,500. So office people started scratching their heads and saying, wait, I need to go out. I just spent $5,000 on this PC and I have to go out and spend another $1,500 on CPM. And the PC already comes with an operating system called DOS. You know what, people? We're going to learn DOS. And here we are, 2014.
And DOS became Windows, and Windows became Windows 95.
You should have seen I had a chance to read the papers, because that company that I worked for 11 years, they were government vendors. They actually dealt with government contracts. And the year that Microsoft Windows 95 came into the picture, after regular Windows, if you remember, the last version of the old Windows was Windows 3.1.1, which was Windows for workgroups. And after that, they had Windows NT, which they stole. Did I say that word out loud? Which they took from Digital.
Apparently they borrowed it heavily.
They borrowed it heavily, correct, until they made a deal with Digital where they split the playing ground. Okay, you limit your Windows NT to 4 processors, and we'll make the Windows NT for all the other, for whatever amount of processors you want. So that's how they broke the playing field, and, you know, that's how they averted yet another lawsuits. But when Windows 95 came out, there was this big issue between Microsoft and the government. Because when the government made an order to upgrade the office computers, and you can imagine how many copies of Windows the government can use at any one time, all the government computer analysts were arguing the point that Windows 95 was not a true operating system, fresh, brand new, fresh out of the box. It was an upgrade to Windows 3.1, because they found DOS running under the hood. They looked under the hood and they saw, you know, 64 kilobit of memory space to keep that initial indexing, and 16-bit command line processor. Everything under the hood was, that's why the Windows 95 is like an inverted pyramid. You have all these applications up to here, like the base of the pyramid is on the top, but everything is going to this little tiny point. And that's why you could crash things so easily in Windows 95. And they argued this. I don't know, I guess, who in the end, it must have been Microsoft who won, or they must have done something to allay another lawsuit. But this kept going back and forth for several months. The government says, we'll pay you for this as an upgrade. We're not paying you for this as a brand new operating system, because it is not. And then also, if you remember, IBM was making noises of OS2 Warp, which was really robust and solid. I put together an OS2 Warp server. I couldn't get it to crash, not even with a hammer. The operating system was so solid. But that's why they came to market with Windows 98. You know, they had a placeholder in the market in order to allay people, you know, don't be interested in this OS2 warping. It's really not that good. You know, you should be looking at this. And then, did you ever get a chance to play with Windows Millennia?
Play? It was built for toys, wasn't it? It was built for like teddy bears that speak. Because you would take it way about 15 minutes for it to boot up. And then you pull the string, nothing would happen for about 12 minutes. And then it would say something out of the blue that I remember Windows Millennium Edition. It was the worst named thing. But the thing is, I just need to find this piece of music because it was
While we're talking about old operating systems, I know this is Geek City. Where did I have it? I made this lovely little thing because I used to install computers. I used to build them for people and install them and stuff like that. Just a lot like Dave used to, and we all kind of had this commonality. And I think the best thing ever, and I can't find it. damn it. I'm looking for this. This is, it was the music that when you loaded, Windows 98, it came up with this fantastic piece of music with this brilliant bass line that lasted 10 seconds. But it was a really cool bit of music, and I wish it had lasted longer. So I did it. I looped it so it lasted about a minute. But now I can't find it. It's somewhere, and I'll dig it out one day. Maybe if I find it, I'll be able to catch it.
You can see they're very wily and very cunning company at marketing.
Yeah, because they got this great piece of music. And there was another, wasn't it, Eno, who had a hand in the music that was the Windows
Brian Eno?
Brian Eno, yeah. Windows 95
music. With Robert Fripp?
Yes. He had something to do with Windows 95's music.
I'm telling you, hands down, they're the best marketing company around.
Right enough, mate. Right enough. Nancy, what did you? I mean, you've been involved in electronic warfare and must have seen the rise of ARPA, stroke DARPA, stroke the internet, etc. What was your experience of the machine age?
Well, the first time I got caught in the new age was when I had to give a briefing to 15 generals, retired generals from the Army Security Agency, which also was called the Super Spooks. But they were the electronic warfare arm of the Army. And I'm being told that this teeny little square thing that must have been about 6 inches tall and about 3 inches thick by 3 inches wide was 3 inches by 3 inches by six, that was going to replace what was the Prick 25, which is a radio that had 25 batteries in it, very, very heavy. So I was embarrassed because these generals started asking me all these questions, and I had no answer. So when I went up to NSA for a visit, I said, don't ever do that to me again. How can you possibly be saying this? And that's when they showed me the first run of microchips. And I understood, where they were going with this technology, and it was, of course, at that point, it was probably about 70, it was probably 73, the end of 73 that I saw that. And it was one of those situations where at that time I really didn't have an understanding of what this meant, the impact, except that it was going to give the soldiers a smaller radio. So then, I was a Soviet military expert for the Army in that I wrote the program instruction that was presented at the Army's Intelligence School, and then I got over into Army Security Agency, which was responsible for electronic warfare. And on that side of it, I was in the signal security, which was basically the defensive side of it. We had to protect our own communications and telecommunications and radars, everything on the battlefield and in strategic, our telephone systems, our radio systems, from the bad guys. And we had to understand what the bad guys could do to us. So because of the connection that I had to have with NSA, they had they put into my office a telephone. And the telephone, the device itself was well over $50,000 because it was really... it looked like a regular telephone, but it was, it would take your voice and it would encrypt it. And then there was another telephone on the other side and it would receive your voice and it would unencrypt it. So it basically sounded like you were talking on regular telephone. There was a little, distortion in it, but not anything that most people would even think about. Well, the only way that could happen was the development of the 50K we called it the gray line. It was a new wire. It was, and I don't even, again, I didn't understand the details of it, but that was the wire that broke open all of the internet, all of the computers, because it could carry so much more information than anything before that. At the time that all of this was happening, a computer system was really a building. And I remember I walk into this building, and from the moment you got inside, it was like one huge computer room after another, huge. And the floors were raised up. I don't even know how high they were, but all these wires were going underneath it, and the building was kept at like 52 degrees or something. You virtually had to wear winter clothes to even work in this place. And what would happen is that somebody from the outside would call into this building, and they'd have like 20 minutes to be able to use the computer system. And then the next guy was up, and the next guy. But after they got the 50K wiring system, they could really create what we've got as a PC now. Because now you can link all these small computers on the desk to other computers to create the internet. So I tell people, I say, you know, technically, I probably was the first person that they've known that was on the beginning of the internet, because there was one phone on my desk, and the second phone on this entire military post was in the communications facility. So, but that was really as far as I went with. It was an interesting thing, because at that time also, you started getting the computer systems, and we call them personal computers now, but at that time they were just smaller computer systems that were not for your one person. It was for one office or one unit or whatever, but they were small, but they're smaller than buildings, but they were still pretty damn big. And so you started having all of these computer systems start up. And within the military, you had the Army using one system, the Navy using another system, the Air Force another system. Nobody could talk to one another. They could talk amongst their own organization, but they couldn't talk between each other. And what happened was that when I was getting out of the military, I was actually approached by one of the major think tanks in the D.C. area to head up an organization their head up their department that had been given the job of making it so that all of the computers could talk to one another. I didn't have to take that job, but that was where they were at that time, was that they still couldn't even talk to each other. So then I had the military, and now I'm a regular person like you guys with no, you know, no special information. Did that answer your question?
Excellent. Excellent. So this was in the 70s?
Yeah. Yeah. 73 to 75. 76.
Cool. I was just on the back channel. I was chatting with Walt, and so I was like the next generation along with... in the university, London, in 1980, I worked there. And I was at the beginning, I was a computer receptionist, which basically took the computer cards and I put them in a box and I gave them to somebody else that would feed them to the computer. We weren't even allowed to touch the computer. But every time I walked in the room, I had to walk over a special carpet that took all the dust off my feet. And it was, yes, as you say, air conditioned and slightly cooler than comfortable. That's right. Just slightly cooler than comfortable. So it was always a fashion decision, you know, whether to go and what to wear to work. I used to play around with the new, cause they had this big computer, which was the one we're talking about. It's like didn't have terminals, and, all you could do is you give it cards and it gave you paper.
explain the cards, because people that, you know, aren't as old as us or been in it this long,
all right,
might not understand what we mean when we talk about a card.
All right. So, all right, let's look at this.
This is what's known as a Hollerith punch card, and it was invented for the IBM Corporation, or it was adopted by the IBM Corporation as an input device for its computer series 360. And it was it had a hopper which took cards. Now, these, when you talk about a card, now let me just imagine the size of it. It was about 8 inches long and about 3.5 inches high. Yeah, probably, yeah, it's longer than it was wide.
Wasn't it the size of an employee punch card when you punch into work?
Exactly one of those. They're quite long, you know, substantial, about 8 inches. And, it was made of a card that was firm enough you could punch a hole in it, the first ones you also come across are like little, what's called mark sense cards, which you circle you rub a pencil in the middle of them. And, lottery cards are like that these days. You rub a pencil in the middle of them to mark which of the options that you're having. Anyway, so, right. Okay. How did I write a program in 1979? All right. I would, take what's known as a coding form, which is a piece of paper with lines that had 80 spaces on them, on a line, and it had about 24 lines per sheet. This is known as a coding sheet or a coding form. And you would write out your program in block capitals in a very specific form, because you had to lie between, you know, certain columns were used for numbering the card and were ignored, and some certain columns were used for program numbers, and then you it was different for data. Anyway, long story. But this coding form was how you wrote your program in a language called Fortran in uppercase block capitals. Very much like, you know, when you fill in a form in the bank or something like that, they force you to write in each character, each box. That's how we used to write. And it does produce a kind of boxy kind of brain. But you can run this stuff very fast in your brain. And so you write programs that do whatever you want to with another bunch of cards that act as your data that somehow you've managed to gather somehow. So then you have these coding forms, and you can, you know, if you've got a big program, there's lots of them. If it gets complex, and you create subroutines on different sheets to do different things, and you can call them from one piece of paper to the other. And then you take this whole stack of paper and you give it to this amazing, wizard lady, called the punch card operator. And in fact, in the early days, there used to be two of them, and they were called the operator and the verifier. And they would take your coding form and type it in onto cards. They would have a big machine. It was like it was about the size of, imagine the dashboard of a car, you know, the width of a car, dashboard of a car, about that wide, kind of gray box. Metal, and there were two keyboards on it side by side, and you'd have and they were usually women, and they would one would type out a card and type out a stack of cards, and then give it to the other woman, who would put it into another hopper and type out exactly the same. And it's exactly like your password verification you get on the internet. If there's a mistake, that they would both have to type the thing in perfectly. And if one of them typed it in badly, there would be a discrepancy shown up. And this was an entirely mechanical process. And so they...
Yeah, because the characters are being translated into two-dimensional coordinates. Wherever the hole is sitting, that represents the character that you wrote.
That's right. There would be a code, you know, two or more holes at particular things.
Correct.
And so this is known as the Hollerith or ASCII. Not ASCII.
It's what we used to call assembler language.
Which
is one step up from binary.
Yeah, no, it's actually the binary representation of the characters. So yeah. Known as EBCDIC, extended binary decimal instruction code. Or something. Binary coded decimal, which essentially is you know, taking your number and turning it into a binary number and then imposing that onto little eight punched holes in the card. And anyway, so it got really complicated. So to actually put information into these cards. And so I would get little stacks of cards. Every person who wrote the program would get their, you know, send them, you know, put, make the coding forms and then check their cards when they got back from the punch card operators. And then they would come and bring them to the reception. And this is the job that I did, really honest. And I would take the stack of cards that were held together by a much thicker piece of card and slightly bigger and a set of rubber bands, elastic bands. And then I would take off the elastic bands and with all the other hundreds of jobs that people would put in, there was a card that would identify everything. And, I would, stack them all together until I got 2,000 cards in a box, in a tray, metal tray that was about 8 inches wide, 4 inches high and about 15 inches long. And, then I was ready to go into the operating room and I walked through the double doors, you know, double hatchway, like an airlock, across the dust absorbing carpet that got changed every week and just eat the dust off my, through into the air conditioned room. And I would then deposit this said, box onto the operator's table and the operator would take this whole stack of cards and thwack it onto the hopper. Type some instructions and the hopper and the machine would go as it ate each of those cards, interpreting the code on the card, and storing it somewhere inside the magnetic raw core memory, little circles of magnetite, hold them inside the thing long enough to run a program, which would then be spat out on the other side of the room in the printer, which was printing 120 characters a second on one line at a time. So it was going chug, 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 chug. It prints a line at a time. So they were called line printers. And it would just show chug, 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 chug all day, squirting out the remnants of the buffered memory of the programs that were running through the computer, which is one of these roomfuls of computers with the whole tape thing and the drum thing and all that stuff. And it was 1979 that I first met it, and it had been running since 1967.
I knew it. In 1960s movies, it's always a voluptuous girl who does that, not you.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I was the voluptuous male. But what, actually, this is where I discovered certain weird skills, which is my syntax, dyslexia. Apparently, I've got this weird form of dyslexia that instead of misspelling words, I see syntax error. For some people, when they look at words, the letters dance around and they can't read or write them. They just can jumble. But I only get that when the syntax of a piece of text, for instance, if there is a spelling mistake or a typographical error, my eye will be drawn to it. It's like a little buzz. And so people would come to me, and as I said, I wasn't a computer programmer at all, but people would come to me because they had nobody else to go to, or they were impatient, and they would like be poring over their paper, and they bring me the sheet, and they say, "What's wrong with my program?" And I don't know. And I said, "Oh, please." And so I would look at it and I would see this little fuzzy sort of movement on the paper. And, I would point to it and I say, "What about there?" And they would say, "Oh yeah, yeah, I should have put a bracket. Thank you very much." And so.
Why aren't you an editor for some world famous publishing house?
Cause to be a proofreader all day, it would destroy my brain. however, I'm pretty good at debugging code when it comes to it, but. It's very intuitive, and if I actually have to get my left brain around it, it takes years. It's a really slow old left brain. So it's a bit of a sort of 1950s Chevy sort of brain. And I much rather use my intuition, which it seems much quicker. Anyway, so that's how I got into computing. Because a few months later they started bringing in a new computer, which was based on a hub spoke design, which meant that there were certain RIM computers that you would do the work on, and the hub computer that stored all the files. And it was the beginning of the distributed system that is now what we call the cloud. They were minis. So we went from the mainframe to the mini, the GC4000 series. It was used a language called Babbage, which was the first of the obsolescent computer program.
Were those equipped with Winchester drives?
Sorry?
Were those equipped with Winchester drives? Or just tape at the time?
No, they had Winchesters, they were the size of a washing machine, and each disc was the size of an LP record.
They were encased in a double blistered kind of thing where you would lower the dome, and it was encased. Yeah,
that's right. Okay, so we caught up. So they're all blue. You know, the IBM 360 wasn't as blue as you'd imagine. It was very kind of a sort of beige. Ugly beige. old computer. It looked like an old 1960s computer. That's exactly what it looked like. And it was it was the end of its life. And, anyway, took a lot. It was really expensive to repair as well. Because they would have to fly in a special, IBM engineer from Germany, because there were very few of them left that knew anything about these machines. And, and they were very fragile. So you could just kind of, that's why you're not allowed to touch them, because an operator, if they wanted a break, they would just run their fingers along the circuit boards at the back of the computer. The alarm bell would ring. In those days, computers, when they crashed, they would ring a bell. It was great. So you knew, time for a break, because we then have to wait for an operator.
You can go home early today.
We could go home early. We could play games, you know, and stuff like that. But anyway, that was the 360, and that went away in the beginning of the 80s. And then I started being a programmer. They drew me into because I started playing with the new, GC4000s, which then got connected with the internet. And then we worked out, well, it wasn't the internet. It was JANET, the Joint Academic Network. And, anyway, so that's when I learned about emails and things like that. So did you come in about that sort of time, Walt?
I'm sorry? Yeah. I'm sorry, you're asking, what did you ask?
Did you come in about that sort of time when mainframes were moving over to minis? And
I had a chance to play with when I went to Long Island University and major in computer science. That was the mainframe that they had at the university at the time. It was a deck unit. You do have just, you know, dumb terminals, text terminals to write your programming. So that's what it looked like at the time. I did see also minis, an IBM mini, the size of a fridge. But at the time they were, the people that were using it, they were using something called RPG, which is a report regenerating program, something of that nature. I never played with it. I just saw them dealing with it. And then when I went to electronics school, they had PCs. So that's when I got my hands dirty with computers.
Excellent. So I spent the next few years after that sort of just writing software for this computer that eventually, like 10 years later, was going to be written out, you know, it's going to be written out of history.
Yeah.
And everything that I'd written, would be lost. You know, it was useless. It was like, I don't know. It was like a bad investment. And
well,
I felt very resentful.
Since you're in Britain, you must be aware, I was understanding that the Amiga computer became a niche computer in Europe. Because a lot of artists were using it to write their music software, because of the way that it fragments memory, it works in discrete 64K memory blocks, and for some reason that makes it easier for them to do their sound mastering. And I had downloaded from the internet several music pieces, you know, gorgeous pieces, and they were all written in the Amiga, which in the U.S. doesn't even exist anymore. If you say that word, nobody knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, the Commodore. I didn't have one of those. I, you know, at that time, computers would then work and play was music. So I used to play with tape recorders and things like that until I was able to get hold of a computer that could do recording. Then my life changed. Then I started, then because a recorder, to get a decent quality sound recorder was really hard to not have hiss. Hiss has been my enemy. Thank you so much, Nancy Hopkins.
Good night.
Walt Silver.
Good night, everyone out there in Radio Land.
Shooting the mental breeze.
Winging it.
Oh, winging it through old times. Good night, everybody.
Love you.
Good night, JP. Good night, Nancy.
Good night. Thanks. Stay online for Muggsy. Bye now.